Hello and welcome to this podcast focusing on the treatment of patients with macular telangiectasia, or MacTel. In this episode, which includes excerpts from a recent educational symposium, Drs. Charles Wyckoff, Jed Assam, Diane Doe, and Dante Pieramici discuss the latest treatment strategies in MacTel, focusing on novel neuroprotective strategies. This activity is provided by PER and supported by an educational grant from Neurotech Pharmaceuticals. To start things off, Dr. Pieramici gives us a brief overview of what macular telangiectasia is, while also reviewing the underlying pathophysiology of this neurodegenerative disease.
I'm going to give a little introduction about MacTel, but I think you're going to hear today about a therapy that, I don't like the word game changer, it's really going to be a life changer for these patients. They're going to be able to maintain vision for many more years, maintain function many more years than they had in the past. And this is something that they haven't had. I'm going to go through some of the history of treatment, and you'll see it's been pretty bleak for these folks. So macular telangiectasia, we're talking about macular telangiectasia type 2, which is generally a bilateral condition, but not always. It affects people probably in sort of mid to late life, but it probably occurs even earlier. We just don't make the diagnosis until the patient's 40 or 50 years of age. And it affects about 0.1% of the U.S. population, so it's sort of considered an orphan disease, but there's probably many cases that we're missing the diagnosis of. And so later you'll hear about some subtleties in the diagnosis that's important. The disease can lead to dilated venules, pigmentary hyperplasia, telangiectatic vessels, yellow crystalline deposits in the retina. Degeneration of the outer retina is important in this disease, and some of the patients can develop neovascularization and atrophy, scarring, and very severe vision loss, central vision loss at the end of the day. It tends to affect, like most macular diseases, more the near vision than the distance vision, reading, seeing faces, these types of things. And the disease really, we've typically classified it into the non-proliferative, which is traditionally not much we could do for it, or the proliferative when choroid neovascularization developed. And we started to use therapies that we use for choroid neovascularization, but the outcomes certainly weren't great. Now, the pathophysiology has changed over the years. I think when I started, we had fluorescein angiograms, and we did fluorescein angiograms, and we saw what looked like leakage, and so we thought this was a vascular disease. But now we know that macular telangiectasia is really a neurodegenerative disease with loss of the Müller cells and photoreceptors central to the development of the disease process. Müller cells are very important in the retina. They're glial cells. They extend throughout the retina. They support all the retinal cells, particularly the photoreceptors. And in particular, they release neurotrophic factors, such as growth factor, brain-derived growth factor, and of course, cilio-neurotrophic factor that we're going to hear about today. MacTel is a disease that progresses. And as you'll see here, it's a slow but persistent progression over time. And remember, these patients are being affected at a much earlier age. So when you're 40 or 50 years old, a slowly progressive disease where you're losing on average one letter of vision a year is going to accumulate over time till, as you see, patients tend to eventually lose some of the central vision. They lose ellipsoid zone. About 75% of the patients progress from no loss of ellipsoid zone or photoreceptors to some loss of it. In those patients, about half of them, the ellipsoid zone loss eventually involves the foveal center, and of course, very severe vision compromise at that point. As I mentioned, we thought this was a vascular disease, and so we tried to treat this with things that we treat other retinal vascular disease, like diabetes or macular degeneration. And people have tried things like anti-VEGF agents, and I can tell you that for the non-proliferative patients, most of the patients, it doesn't do a whole lot. You might be able to reduce the leakage a little bit, maybe the OCT look a little bit better, but you're not going to do much for the eyes. And this was looked at in a large study here, a number of studies. This is a systematic review of 10 studies. Four were prospective, looking at using aflibercept, bevacizumab, or ranibizumab over 2 years, very little change in the visual acuity, very little improvement. Many of these studies showed no improvement at all using anti-VEGF agents. But there does seem to be a benefit, again, for anti-VEGF agents in the rare patient that develops choroid neovascularization. So I do think there's still a role potentially for those patients. Other things that have been tried, of course, we had lasers back in the days, and we used to laser everything, including trying to laser macular telangiectasia. I wouldn't recommend it. It's probably going to just cause more neurodegenerative problems. So, yeah, focal laser really doesn't do much. Photodynamic therapy, when we got that tool, we started using that tool on everything, and I think now we've realized it works for central serous, and that's about it, but it does work pretty well for that. But not for macular telangiectasia, so I wouldn't recommend that either. You can use oral carbonic anhydrase inhibitors, and this is another one. It always makes the OCT look better, but doesn't do a whole lot for the vision or the progression of the disease process. So, yeah, if you want to make the picture look better, then you can do that, but it really doesn't benefit the patient at all. And finally, pars plana vitrectomy. I see these cases every once in a while where a patient comes in and they've had a vitrectomy for an epiretinal membrane. And as you'll see clinically, sometimes it looks like an epiretinal membrane, but that's just part of the retina they're removing. And so I wouldn't recommend that either. It doesn't help at all. So let me ask my esteemed panel a couple of questions here and how they've managed over the years until we have something new. Diane, I'll start with you. So how have you managed these non-proliferative patients, not the ones with choroid neovascularization, but what have you tried or what do you do for your patients today not yet having the new therapy?
I think it was a very challenging disease in the past because observation was the standard of care. And we saw that over time, slowly, these patients would complain about deficits in their reading, scotomas, even though their vision on the chart was still quite good, you know, 20, 30, 20, 40, but they would complain about a poor quality of vision. And it was unfortunate that we did not have an effective treatment until now. I think that's why it's very exciting.
So you didn't do anything then?
Yes, yep. It's just observation. But yep. We saw if you had imaging, serial imaging over years, that there was progression of the disease over time. It's slow, but it's inevitable.
Jed, did you ever try anything? You're a young vitreoretinal surgeon. Have you offered anything to patients?
Yeah, I think very much in line with what Deanna was saying, the best therapy is really education for these patients, helping them understand the disease process. Really not much in the way of intervention at this point in time, so.
Charlie, if the patient you think has developed choroidal neovascularization, how do you approach that patient?
Yeah, I think that's really the sole exclusion where anti-VEGF therapy is useful. Now, where I trained 20 years ago, there was a physician that was using anti-VEGF therapies for the non-proliferative form, and the leakage would go away on fluorescein, but it did nothing to change the course of the disease. So I think that I agree that's not useful. But if they have proliferative disease, if they have a CNVM, I do think they need treatment. Some of those people can come off treatment, so I treat them sort of as needed or treat and extend and then try to discontinue in most cases.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think that's historically that we've tried a lot. As retina specialists, we always like to take our tools out and try to use them to help folks, but most of them have been not very helpful, particularly for the non-proliferative disease. And even if you treat the proliferative disease, you're still back to square one with progressive neurodegenerative disease.
Next, Dr. Jed Assam walks us through some of the novel therapies for patients with MacTel.
So the therapy that we're going to be discussing really focuses around the benefits of ciliary neurotrophic factor as a protective feature for the neurons. Ciliary neurotrophic factor in preclinical models of retinal degeneration photoreceptors can show elements of rescue, which has previously been demonstrated with intravitreal injections. And this works through the JAK-STAT pro-survival pathway with intracellular signaling. An introduction to revokinin gene teriretcel, the therapy did first become approved in March of this year for the treatment of MacTel, which has been an exciting progression for these patients. The treatment does consist of surgically implantable semipermeable capsule that has 200 to 440,000 genetically modified retinal pigment epithelial cells designed to specifically secrete and release CNTF into the vitreous cavity. When we look at the latest trial results, so there were two mirrored phase 3 clinical trials, NTMT-03A and 03B, which were identical study designs. Some of those key inclusionary criteria were patients selected between age of 21 and less than 80, focus on ellipsoid zone break between 0.16 millimeters squared and 2 millimeters squared for area affected, and a best corrected visual acuity that was 54 EDTRS letters or 2080 or better. Patients after implantation were followed on a traditional post-operative day one, week one, month one, as well as month three, with additional data points obtained at 6 months, 12, 16, and 20 and 24 months. The primary endpoint was the easy area loss with additional data points for microperimetry as well as reading speed obtained during the course of the study. As far as the rate of change of the area of easy loss through baseline of 20 to 24 months, that was the primary focus of the endpoint of the study. And then we kind of mentioned the secondary endpoints being change in retinal sensitivity measured by microperimetry, and then additionally the monocular reading speed, as well as the NEI VFQ25 for near activities, focusing on what Dante had mentioned of more patients having near affected vision with MacTel. Secondary endpoints were based on safety, including the number of subjects who had a 15-letter loss in best-corrected visual acuity, and then number of proportion of subjects with greater than or equal to one treatment-emergent serious adverse event. As far as demographics, the studies between the two, again, were mirrored and represented pretty closely. Key things to take away, the majority of patients were female, Caucasian, as well as ages less than 65, and then the remaining areas of ellipsoid zone loss were measurable between the two different groups. As far as the primary efficacy finding, the main focus again was easy area loss at 24 months, where we have panels A and B displaying the rate of change of ellipsoid zone for treatment and sham groups between MTMT03A and MTMT03B, respectively. These were based on linear regression models, longitudinal mixed model, controlling for within participant variability and treatment groups and the time. There was a 54% and 30% roughly reduction in the retinal degeneration in the NT501 versus sham groups and NTMT03A and NTMT03B respectively. The panel C and D, as you can see, display the observed mean change in the area of the ellipsoid zone from baseline to 24 months and the treated and sham groups in the MTMT03A and MTMT03B, respectively. With the secondary efficacy findings, change in aggregate sensitivity loss, the NTMT03A versus the MTMT03B, the A did show a difference between the treatment group versus the sham, versus in the B, there was not a mean change between the two. Safety events, ultimately, the majority were mild in severity. In terms of cases of endophthalmitis, there were none. There was one case of extrusion, which was reimplanted, and the majority of those safety events were more related to surgical suture-related events. As far as adverse events noticeable by patients, there was a description of delayed dark adaptation along with an effect of meiosis.
Continuing the discussion, Dr. Wyckoff informs us more about some of the key safety and efficacy data on the surgically implanted therapy NT501.
I'm going to go through three or four other analyses that have informed our discussion with patients about this surgical implant that produces CNTF for the treatment of patients with MacTel. And I'm going to give you a few specific numbers, because right, data can become overwhelming. And these are some numbers that I actually quote with patients. So the first, I think, is an impactful analysis where the three prospective randomized trials that have looked at Tararetzel, the data from all three of them have been combined to give kind of one summary output. And here are the three numbers that I try to remember. So one is when you put all the data together for all three of the randomized trials, there's been a 36% reduction in photoreceptor loss through 2 years. That's a meaningful number. You see meaningful separation of these curves. 36% is what I talk to patients about. Because I show them their pictures. I show them where the photoreceptor layer is missing on the OCT, and I say, this is getting larger over time, as Dr. Doe beautifully pointed out, and we're going to slow that down meaningfully. The second number to think about is very close, 35% reduction in loss of retinal sensitivity. Even though the images are easier to explain based on what you have in front of you, this is much more impactful to the patient, as is the next slide, right? They're preserving more visual tissue in their macula by 35%. That's a big deal. We're not just talking about anatomy in this room. We're talking about preserving actual function. So it's a big deal. And the last number is the biggest number, which is a 68% reduction in reading speed loss. And this is maybe the easiest one for patients to understand, because patients with MacTel, with these ellipsoid zone losses, invariably, if they're forced to do it in a monocular level, will have reading difficulty. They're going to say, yeah, it's getting more difficult to read. I can still read, but my eye jumps around, I miss letters. Talk to them. Ask them specifically about reading with one eye at a time. And then you can say, look, with this treatment, we're going to slow it down by almost 70%. That's a big number. We're not talking single-digit slowing. We're talking 70% reduction in how much reading speed they're losing through just 2 years. Then the next one, to me, is the most impactful of all of these as sort of a scientist and as a physician with my friends up here, and that is, how long does this thing last? So when you give your anti-VEGF injections, what do you tell your patients? This is a one and done? No, of course not. You say, well, I'll see you in a month, or I'll see you in 2 months. Because they and you inherently get it. It's going to wear off. You got to keep doing it over and over and over. This, we think, could be different. So here's data from 65 patients that have had the implant explanted. After many years, up to 14 and a half years after implantation. And the question is, how much drug are these implants still making? Because if they wear off after a couple years, that would be a problem. But what's amazing about the data is that it doesn't. It's consistent all the way out through 14 and a half years. So these little cells, as Jed pointed out, 300,000 of these little biofactories in there are working for over a decade, 14 and a half years. And what probably happens is, if one cell dies, the one next to it probably divides and then is contact inhibited by its neighbors next to it. So they're constantly filling a void, and the oxygen and glucose in your vitreous is feeding these cells indefinitely. That's what the data looks like, and that's what the data has shown very clearly. So it's nice to be able to tell patients, look, we're collecting more data as we go, but we have over 14 years worth of data, and your implant will keep working. The last analysis thing is critical also is looking at a long-term safety follow-up with up to 8 years of follow-up from patients that have had the surgical implantation. And the major side effect I mentioned, Jed mentioned this, thank you, is the possibility of needing to explant the device. Right? If you're going to do a surgical procedure to treat a patient, you got to mention any potential need for additional surgery. And that risk is small. It was about 2 patients out here out of 51 patients, one of them almost 10 years after implantation, and one of them 6.5 years after implantation had the device removed. And the way I describe that to patient is, look, you put a foreign body inside of the human body, and sometimes that doesn't work. It's gonna wiggle, it's gonna move, it's gonna touch the structures next to it, and that might cause a problem for which we would need to go back in surgically and either take it out or fix that problem. We'll talk in more detail about that, because surgical technique is also really important in minimizing this risk. With the long-term safety follow-up, we also got a view into long-term efficacy, and this is amount of photoreceptor loss over time. So you're seeing consistently through 8 years of follow-up, you're having protection of your photoreceptors and less loss. With that, I'm going to ask my excellent panel some questions. So which patients are most appropriate for this therapy? How are you thinking about this therapy in your practice, Jed? Maybe I'll start with you.
So it's one of those therapies that when you're focused on preventing progression, the earlier you can identify somebody, the better it is going to be for them in the long term. Oftentimes, I think with a newer therapy, we're all very conservative, and I think that's going to be one of the balances, is a lot of treatment will be focused initially on the worst of the two eyes for balancing out and ensuring your own personal comfort with it. But that's how I would see implementing and having the conversation. When I talk to my patients about it, really focus on helping them understand and then think about it before we walk through any further steps.
Thanks, great comment. And Dr. Doe, what about you? As you're a busy clinician, a clinical scientist, What types of patients are you thinking could be appropriate here?
There's a spectrum of symptoms in MacTel type 2, and we have some patients who are asymptomatic who I think may be too early to consider the implant. So I would usually present the data to someone who is more symptomatic, where we can see on OCT imaging that there is some disruption of the ellipsoid zone or the external limiting membrane. Those patients, I think, are more motivated at this time to consider an invasive implant. So I would definitely want to assess their symptoms and how it's affecting their quality of life and then go forward with that. One interesting point about your elegant surgery, Charlie, you know, we've also had experience with the port delivery system, and that is also kind of like implanted to the sclera. It's interesting the surgical difference where here with the revokinogene, we do not need to apply any laser to the incision, the choroid, to prevent vitreous hemorrhage. But in the port delivery system, that is actually the laser is recommended. Why do you think there's a difference between the two and that we're not seeing the complications we did with the PDS compared to revokinogene?
It's a great thought, and I actually had two thoughts to that. One is I technically myself prefer the non-laser approach. I like to leave, you know, human tissue wherever possible intact when it's non-pathologic, and so I like not ablating that choroid. I think in this case it's not necessary because there's no permanent structure rubbing against the choroid. The hope is, the goal is to fixate the polypropylene suture to the sclera and then have it dangle into the vitreous and then attach to the titanium loops. Nothing chronically rubbing against the choroid, which could cause bleeding, is my thought. What about you, Diana? What do you think about that?
I think that makes sense. So maybe there's also a difference in the size as well. Maybe the PDS, even though it's small, because it's kind of more like pressured into the incision and held there because of its big flange, maybe, as you said, there's more mechanical injury that can occur with time, and hence the higher risk of postoperative vitreous hemorrhage.
Great observations. Thank you. And Dante, what about you? What kind of patients are you thinking about this? Are you bringing it up with all MacTel patients just because they should be aware of it? Are you selectively mentioning it to certain patients? How do you think of it?
No, I mean, I think it's a conversation you should have with all MacTel patients. I mean, certainly if they're at the end of the spectrum where there's already very little vision centrally in the eye, I don't know that that patient would benefit. I think this is a progressive disease process, like Jed mentioned. So really, fundamentally, we want to treat these patients earlier. And the data seems to show that they do better, the patients that are treated earlier as well. It's a bilateral disease, so patients are going to have two eyes. And, you know, it's a slowly progressive disease, so there's no rush. I mean, you can introduce this idea early on. You can watch them over a shorter period of time and sort of see how things are progressing. And certainly, I think that if you had two eyes and one eye's worse than the other, I might even consider starting in the bad eye just to get them a sense of how the device is going to go, the surgical procedure is going to go. But then encourage them that, yeah, really the best benefit you're going to get is out of your better eye in the long run. So these patients are probably going to end up with bilateral implants, unless one eye is so bad it couldn't benefit from it. So again, earlier therapy is going to be better in the long run. But we have time here to sort of introduce the idea and get the patient comfortable with what's going to happen.
All great comments. News flash, we have a question, so I'll take it, then you guys can answer. So the first question is, can you speak to delayed dark adaptation? How significant? Is it related to CNTF? So I've done multiple of these implants, and I'll tell you that I do always mention the possibility of the pupil being different. We know that one of the potential adverse side effects of CNTF can be the pupil size can change, can get smaller, and there can be a dark adaptation delay. Now, critically, when I describe that to patients, I say, look, it's going to, we think when you have this, it changes your time of becoming able to see in darker situations, but it doesn't make you blind in the dark. It's not a permanent change of vision in the dark. It just will delay that time when you go from a bright area to a dark area to where you adapt. I think when patients understand that, they're less concerned about it. But I think there is a little bit of education necessary for patients about this. A, they should be aware of it. We know this potential finding with it. But second, we want to make sure they understand what it truly means. Jed, you walked through the phase 3 data. What's your understanding of those potential adverse events?
I think your capture on the pupil sizes as a key component of that, when you don't have the natural dilation, that is going to be a factor for delayed dark adaptation.
So with that, Dan, I'm going to pass it back to you to take us through some imaging.
Well, it's really wonderful that we have all this background about what the disease is, what the clinical trial shows, and now let's look at real clinical cases because all of us are in the trenches seeing patients every day. How can we identify macular telangiectasia type 2? So let's start off with this case. This is, you know, an elderly gentleman walks into your clinic, Jed. You get your OCT. They're complaining of scotomas and difficulty reading. We see the fundus photograph. We see the OCT. Can you describe to us what you see on this image?
Yeah, so attention is going to be first drawn to the temporal macular area. You're going to be looking for right angle venules. You've also got some early features of temporal macular grain, which are more characteristic of the disease. Then I would switch over to my OCT, and you've got kind of that characteristic ILM draping, which Dante had kind of mentioned some people might be deceived into thinking that's an early ER causing distortion, but you've got more cavitary changes in that central foveal area. And then you're next going to be looking down at the photoreceptor layer, looking for that characteristic ISOS disruption.
That's great. This is so astute, and obviously you're very experienced with macular telangiectasia. But Dante, you know, a lot of us sometimes, it's a rare disease. We don't see thousands of patients every year with MacTel. When you see these hyporeflective spaces on the OCT, some of us might think initially, is this macular edema? Could this be another retinal vascular disease? Do you think we need to get a fluorescein angiogram to differentiate between MacTel type 2 or other masquerading syndromes?
No, I don't. I wouldn't get a fluorescein. I mean, particularly in a case like this, pretty classic appearance. There are cases, though, where, you know, there are a few telangiectatic vessels. Is it a small branch retinal vein occlusion or something else? And if I didn't have a classic picture on OCT and fundus photograph like this, one could consider, you know, differentiating, say, a vein occlusion or some other retinal vascular disease like diabetic retinopathy from this, and it would be the constellation of findings in both of the eyes in different areas, not just in the juxtafoveal telangiectatic area.
Great. Let's look at the fluorescein angiogram. We mentioned we do not need it for the diagnosis, but if you recall, there are some key findings if you were to obtain the fluorescein angiogram. Here's one of that left eye. Charlie, can you describe what you see on the angiogram?
Yeah, you see the classic temporal leakage just adjacent to the fovea there. Sometimes there can be some microaneurysmal changes there, and critically you want to look at the fellow eye because usually there's symmetry. There does not have to be, but that symmetry is a key finding. And then on the OCTA down there, some little distortion of the temporal fovea, again with those telangiectatic vessels.
Yes, and we said MacTel type 2, you get usually a bilateral temporal to the foveal mild leakage, and we sometimes want to differentiate this from the neovascular type because there's a rare subset of patients who can develop retinal neovascularization. How would you tell the difference on OCT or on fluorescein angiogram, Jed, someone who has typical MacTel type 2 or someone who has neovascularization that might be a candidate for anti-VEGF therapy?
For further differentiation, you can consider adding in the ICG component to your fluorescein angiogram, looking for the CNV, and then with the benefits of OCTA, you could also be incorporating that as well to try and see the classic type 2 lesion.
Great. Yes, and another tip would be sometimes if there is neovascularization, that hyperfluorescence is much more brighter. And then also in OCT, you might see these hyperreflective subretinal deposits, which could represent that membrane. Now let's look at this fundus photograph. This is a patient who came in complaining of, you know, decrease in reading speed, just difficulty seeing some letters on the computer. He was told he might have MacTel type 2, and we see this kind of grayish sheen in both eyes. You know, usually when you just get the fundus photograph, I don't think it's enough usually to make the diagnosis. What's your go-to test, Dante, if you were suspecting MacTel type 2? Is it just the OCT? Is it a combination of multimodal imaging?
Well, like most things, I think multimodal imaging is helpful. You know, the fundus photograph is great. I think OCT, if I was on a deserted island and I could only have one modal image, yes, it would probably be OCT, because I think that tells you more than anything else. Fluorescein angiogram, you know, again, you don't need it many times. ICG, not very many times. And OCTA can add a little bit. I think OCTA adds mostly when they think there's choroidal neovascularization, but OCT, just regular OCT, would be my go-to on the desert island.
Great. Well, I think we covered all these questions as we went through our imaging kind of gallery of all these presentations. I think the key is we need to get the OCT. There's some characteristic findings. The fluorescein is not necessary, but it can be helpful, especially if you're suspecting any neovascularization. And fundus autofluorescence can also be helpful because you lose some of that hyperautofluorescence in the temporal foveal area when there's loss of lutein and zeaxanthine in this type of condition.
Thanks for listening to this podcast. We hope you enjoyed hearing the real-world perspectives from our faculty panel. For more information on this topic, click on the link in the podcast description.